Okay, so Henry?
Henry Laxson. I've been in the East, I guess. Japan, China, Malaysia, Singapore. But just as a tourist. Well, actually, we worked with a Japanese company for a few years.
Yeah.
And they're ruthless.
I know.
So be careful. If you ever work with a Japanese company, be careful.
Yeah.
They haven't built a railway yet.
And?
My name's Dan Erickson. I've never been to the, well, I've been to the Asia way out in the Aleutians, so I passed the 180 line, but that doesn't really count. But yesterday, my wife and I just celebrated our 35th anniversary, and she's Korean, so I got that going for me. But other than that, I do have to leave a little early today. I heard about this meeting after I'd already made plans for this afternoon, so I've got to split it about 4:45.
No problem.
Well, let me ask, was your wife born in Korea?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, Busan.
Yes, and when did she come to the U.S.?
She came to America in about 77.
Yeah, and how old was she then?
How old was she then? Probably about 18, I guess.
18,
Hi, I'm Cy Seyfried. I've never been to the East, but I've read about... I've been very interested in Buddhism for many years, and interested in really ancient civilizations, particularly as a source of what we have as religion today, like the Sumerians, etc. So that's kind of my interest.
Especially Buddhism.
Oh, that's great. You took it over?
Right.
No, this is great. This is great news.
Yeah. Okay, Phil. Phil is going to...
I'm quite happy with you.
Okay, bye.
I'm Phil Ryland. I've been to the East. I've been as far as Chapala. And I found it to be inscrutable. Absolutely inscrutable. Okay. Are we going around?
You're going around. Can you move around so we can see you to the side? So
I think
you
should be there.
No, we have to at least be,
Yes.
That's just a Western wind.
I'm Sandy.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yes. And Sandy, have you had any experience with the Eastern culture?
Not directly, no.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any classes? Has anybody had any classes in university or whatnot on Eastern philosophy or history?
Nothing.
I'm tainted by Western ideals of Eastern philosophy.
Yes, right, exactly. It's a white horse, right? Really white.
My name is Sherry, and I've been to China, India, worked in Thailand. I have a daughter that went to a year of school in Japan, and now I stepson and adopted son that's in teaching in Vietnam, and he taught in Korean.
Mm-hmm.
I might have to go to a wedding in 4 or 5 months in Vietnam.
Well, I'm going in 2 weeks, so you want to come with me?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I sat under the bar.
And your name?
My name is Arden Murphy.
Arden. Oh,
and
yes,
I sat under the bar.
But you said butterfly originally.
The
butter.
The Bodhi tree.
Yeah.
The butter tree.
The butter tree.
No, no.
The Bodhi tree.
Oh.
B-O-D-H-I, the Bodhi tree.
Oh, the Bodhi tree.
The Bodhi tree.
Yes.
Still alive, right?
Yes. Nothing fell on his head.
The marshmallow-looking Buddha. Okay. Oh, so I'm Valerie Edwards. And, we moved to Japan in 1970. My husband was with IBM, and he was the only person in the world, including Japanese, to work for 3 Japanese banks putting in software systems, and I had to learn Japanese quickly because 3 daughters. Japan had nothing in 1970 in English or anything written in English. So,
wow.
Watashi wa Nihongo wa nashimasu. So, and then I have studied in Bhutan and Thailand and was in China coming down from the north for the United Nations Women's Conference into Beijing and then other countries. And then I studied early 80s at UC Santa Cruz with a special teacher, professor, known for studies in China and Japan. So I'm very fascinated with, I do have a Japanese son-in-law. My grandchildren have Japanese, but they don't know that. Okay.
I'm John Stockdyke. Like Henry, I've been to the Far East as a tourist. Since 2012, reading Sam Harris's book, Waking Up, I've had some interest in Buddhism, so I've been doing some reading and thinking along those lines.
Okay.
Lou Reskin, I've been to Japan and Korea, and have done some studies around Buddhist philosophies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not the religion per se, but the philosophies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good. So I wanted to welcome everybody to Free Thinkers. Not. I think if you're born in the world where you are, that you're imprinted with ways of thinking, environment, and whatnot. And so last week in the New York Times, there was an article on St. John's College, the Santa Fe, New Mexico campus, which opened in 1964, and it's based on the great books. I don't know if you know it. The other campus at St. John's is in Annapolis, Maryland, founded in the 1600s, where I met my husband, and it's based on the great books. And but I was interested in the article because St. John's attitude is not free thinking, it's freeing the mind, and that's their logo, freeing the mind. It's based on Oxford and Cambridge. You only have tutorials and seminars. It's very intense. They only allow 400 student body. And it was intense for me because I was just the third class of women allowed in and dealing with all of you men. Having the problem of that. So it is freeing the mind. And that's, I think, what we all try to achieve. And my first year at St. John's, I was pounded with not bringing in anything from our lives as Christians or whatnot, because it was based on Greek studies and classical time of Greek. So anyway, but there is one thing about all humans that I've known on the earth, is that we all share the same emotions, but we do not share the same senses, because seeing, smelling, hearing are defined by the environment in which you go. And some of you were here, and Phil wasn't. I brought the painting again. I was hoping Lloyd would be here because he had trouble. This is Salvador Dali's painting. And last time, leading the discussion, do I have it upside down?
Yes.
I have it upside down. Yes. So I've used this in lectures quite a number of times. But I only used it on how Europeans see what's in the painting and what Americans or Canadians see. And so poor Lloyd, do any of you, what do you remember? You were here.
Yeah,
okay,
so, it is.
Yeah. So Phil, what did you see?
I ordered chocolate.
What do I see in the painting?
Yeah.
I see pixelation ahead of its time. I see either a sunrise or a sunset, semi-transparent woman, those images of Lincoln, is it? And someone else I'll see from here. Or I see eternity, I see bliss, I see.
Objects. Yeah, it's just objects because I've said this before. There's the adage, if I hadn't have seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. It really is, if I hadn't have believed it, I wouldn't have seen it. And so when I do this, Europeans immediately see Lincoln. they cannot see the others. Americans, Canadians see the nude woman, the sunset, the cross. It's like that. So what's interesting, though, and some of you computer geeks.
Tony, can I just say, what is your premise? Because I'm going to be,
you
know, we're going to be trading off. Well, what is your basic premise?
The basic premise
Of your argument.
The basic premise, basically, is, and I'll read it in a minute, okay?
Okay.
Just give me a minute. And so, because I want this kind of thing to come out about what you see and what you don't see, and what, basically, later the senses of it. So, also, I did have fun. Never the Twain Should Meet, which was by Rudyard Kipling, and I believe that. And so, this I found, and this is, this was in the New York Times, and it's East and West, seeing the world through different lenses. East is East and West is West, and the difference between them is starting to turn up even on brain scanners. New brain research is adding high-tech evidence to what lower-tech psychology experiments have found for years. Culture can affect not just language and custom, but how people experience the world at stunningly basic levels. What they see when they look at a city street, for example, or even how they perceive a simple line in a square. Western culture, they have found, conditions people to think of themselves as highly independent entities. And when looking at senses, Westerners tend to focus on central objects more than on their surroundings. In contrast, East Asian cultures stress interdependence. When Easterners take in a scene, they tend to focus more on the context as well as the object, the whole block, say, rather than the BMW parked in the foreground. To use a camera analogy, the Americans are more zoom and the East Asians are more panoramic, said Dr. Denise Park of the Center for Brain Health. The Easterner probably sees more and the Westerner probably sees less, but in more detail. In January, researchers led by Trent Hedden and John Gabriel of MIT showed that such deeply ingrained habits of thought affects the brains of East Asians and Americans, even as they perform simple tasks that involve estimating the length of a line. Hedden's experiment involved two tasks. In one, subjects eyeballed a line simply to estimate its length, a task that played to American strengths. In another, they estimated the line's length relative to the size of a square, an easier task for the Asians. Brain scanners measure levels of neural activity by tracking blood flow. The experiment found that though there was no difference in performance, the tasks were very easy. The level of activity in the subjects' brains differed, suggesting different levels of effort. Areas linked to attention lit up more in the Americans' brains when they worked on the task they tend to find harder, estimating the line size relative to the square. In Asians, too, the attention areas lit up more during the harder task, estimating the line's length without comparing it to the square. Those findings, published in the journal Psychological Science, echo more than a decade of previous experimental research into East-West differences that are so fundamental that people tend to not be consciously aware of them. A University of Michigan professor even wrote a 2003 book about it, The Geography of Thought. That's really important. But brain scan data add new heft to such findings. At Stanford, who collaborated on the Gabriella paper, brain findings may help people become aware of deep cultural differences that are normally so much part of the water that we don't see them. Such differences have turned up in experiment after experiment. For example, in one study, researchers offered people a choice among five pens, four red and one green. Easterners are likelier to choose a red pen, while Westerners more often chose a green pen. In an experiment measuring how well 8-year-olds could solve puzzles, American children performed best when solving puzzles they had chosen themselves, while Asian children performed best when solving puzzles they were told their mothers had chosen for them. American children brought up in an independence-minded culture felt best when they were exercising free choice, while the Asian children assumed that their mothers had their best interest at heart. So I felt that that was a basic kind of thing talking about the major differences is what I found among living among Japanese and whatnot.
How do you think Mexican children would feel?
Well, that's, I wanted to keep the talk on basically the East, which also I wanted to say with your travels, that I want to only talk about and think about China, Japan, and take away India because of 200 years of colonialism, which stamped itself, and also the Indonesian, Malaysian populations, which are very intermixed. The Japanese culture is very, very homogenetic. So it's interesting to look at Japan and what they did basically historically. 1868 in Europe was throwing out all the monarchies. Japan was a closed society under Tokugawa. And 1868, without the influence of European countries, threw out the shogun. I always found that fascinating, that somehow in the context of maybe emotions, they didn't like the kind of stifling culture of the Tokugawa shogunate. So I thought that was interesting to me to find that these, and I put those toward more the emotional situations that it would happen, even though they were not influenced by Europe, that, excuse me.
So your Eastern thought is defined solely by Japan and China.
Well, I'm
and the Western thought is solely by the United States.
By
and Europe, yeah.
And Europe.
Yes.
All of Europe.
Yes, because I think we're a culture of Americans that are mixed from Europe.
Where does the Middle East fit into that? It seems to be the origin that, things come from. So it's to me, it's very difficult to
know
that.
Yeah, the Middle East, which I know and been, is very different. So I've cut out the Middle East because they're heavily influenced by other religions and other cultures being on the Mediterranean area. So China was more isolated than Japan also. So when we talk about Eastern culture, we're not talking about Middle Eastern, which is kind of an integration of other cultures. It's not as pure in thought or these things as China and Japan.
Although once Buddhism came to China,
yes,
that changed their whole way of looking at things.
Yes, well, as Buddhism came in, 550 BC.
Didn't reach China until much later.
It came into India, exactly, for 550. Taoism, 551, kind of similar and tied together with Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came into China. What was interesting is it was a new type of religion, and it was with the emperors and their higher classes in China that were fascinated by it. And then they kind of threw it out and then allowed the lower classes to have access. And that's where I believe, this is my thoughts about where all of these prayer wheels and things like Catholicism with its rosary beads. And I think when it comes down to the lower classes, that they need something, tactile.
So you think Japan and China are extremely similar in their way of looking at the world?
There is a similarity, but not.
Okay.
Not. But when we talk about the East and why I say that you could never said to my professor, you should only live in Japan 3 years because after that you'll get the mistaken notion that you understand.
I bet that's true in any part of the country.
Yeah.
That is definitely true here.
Because Japanese has no future tense, it has no word for no in the polite form of the language, and is also into reincarnation. and Shintoism besides Buddhism. And so their ideas about time and future tense and things like that, the similarity somehow in China and Japan has to do with time elements and, you know, future tenses. And also Buddhism and this kind of other kind of thought.
I guess I'm asking you now, I may be stealing Till's thunder a little bit. If you made Venn diagrams, China, Japan, Europe, the United States, they would have far more overlap, you think, Japan and China, than it they would have with any other culture.
No, no.
Okay.
No, they fought each other, you know.
why did it become two cultures and generalize them between splitting the world in two, basically West and East?
We didn't have, what did I ask about, did you ever have any classes? And I think with my husband and myself, with all our educational background and universities, as we were on our way from London to Japan, we were angered because we knew nothing about Japanese history, except that they bombed Pearl Harbor. Or China, we didn't have Eastern studies on any place. Actually, the only place was 150 years ago at UC Berkeley. And I do believe that's because of the huge Chinese influence there that had come over for the railroads, the mines, and by that time they had settled and created a strong community. So UC Berkeley was the only place at that time that had Eastern studies. So that's, you know.
But isn't that true of all other cultures? I mean, you could pick any two disparate cultures and claim the same thing.
Yeah, so true.
Right? I mean,
here's what they have in common.
Yeah.
Here's what they don't.
Here's what they don't.
Oh, well.
And I'm curious why just West and East? There's been this.
Because the issue was, and I think your argument was, I said that knowing so much and living so much that in the East and that the East will never meet the West. That it's a superficial layer.
I could say the same about living in the U.S. after living in the U.K.
Yeah. Oh, I lived in the UK too,
yeah.
But I felt that the thought processes, the language and whatnot were, philosophy and studies were all something that I was capable of totally understanding and believing that I could be part of this East or Western society because of the belief system. The Western society is so based on alpha and omega, beginning and an end. And we're based on threes, with everything based on threes, religion, government, and structures and things like that. The Eastern world is based on fives and sevens.
I don't follow that at all. What do you mean based on threes?
Well,
if you
watch that from Euclidean times and the pyramids and the structure, that there became this situation of indoctrination that I talked about, that if you're born in the West, you will start thinking in threes. You'll divide your papers in threes. We divide theater in threes. Then you start looking around, and you see everything divided in three parts. And I do a lecture on painting and how you cut your canvases in three parts, both vertically and laterally, without you knowing you're doing that. So if you stop to then think about how many things, stoplights and stuff like that, are divided in threes, and you don't find that in the East.
I think they have three lights on their stoplights, too.
Yes, but that's a... they don't pay attention to them, because all the taxi drivers...
I'm wondering if, like those comparisons you made to studies with children, that's real vague and general when you just say East and West, whereas, like, you guys have probably done that... thing that I did once, the Myers-Briggs personality test.
Right, right.
Whereas if you compared Eastern and Western, but they each were the same type of personality character, they might do the same whether they were from the East or the West.
I found that with my grandchildren that are born in the U.S. Their grandparents are Japanese, live not far away in New York, and they've heard in there. My son-in-law, now he gets caught between two cultures. Because he was born in New York, but taken back to Japan at a very early age, and then brought back by mid school. And he gets upset and will every once in a while yell at me, "You don't understand, I'm Japanese, I'm the yellow peril." But I can see his conflict with thoughts And when we get into very deep conversations on philosophy, he gets caught between these two worlds and can't think that way.
I agree with you 100% that the culture influences your thinking.
Yes, it does.
But I think, for instance, I think the Mexican culture has more in common with China and Japan than it does with the United States, despite being in the West.
I've been here for 14 years. And it's
very, on about a very, very interesting course in the Great Courses, uh-huh. Probably the best I've ever listened to. The, what would you call them, the socio-economists or whatever that study this, divide the world into like 12 divisions, and then they measure them on something like 10 or 12 dichotomies, independence versus interdependence, or, you know, the different way they look at time, event time versus clock time, all of those. Mm-hmm. And on those, in 8 out of 10 of those, Mexico was 180 degrees from the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I don't see it purely integrated into Japanese business kind of things.
I'm just suggesting that different cultures are different.
Yeah. Well, that's
and
for
that
sure.
There's not necessarily just an east-west dichotomy.
Don't ever in Italy ask, why can't I have my coffee with my dessert? You will not get an answer.
I'm really saying that if you present this problem to Easterners and Westerners, you get the following results. If you show them a picture of a train, a car, and a railroad track, the Westerners will choose the train and the car, and the Easterners will choose the railroad and the track because they're more involved with association between things rather than physical similarities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I searched for the source for that.
Yeah.
And I could not find it despite hours of looking. And I don't know whether this is characteristic of the difference between West and East, is that in the 18th century, or the 19th century, when Eastern philosophy first started to arrive in the West, we created this.
Mm-hmm.
We created this division, which is endured. But really, it's no more than a different division, as Sandy was saying, between any other culture, which affects our thinking. And I readily agree with you.
Yeah.
But I would say the basic premise of all philosophy is equal. You can look at the the ancient philosophers of philosophers of China and Greece, and they're saying the same thing.
Well, basically, and this is something I just learned. You know, Confucius, that wasn't his name. His name was Master Kong. It was the Jesuits that came later and met him and whatnot and gave him the name Confucius, which is Latinized. So, fun, interesting. But anyway... Pardon?
They actually met Confucius?
No, they went much later and then decided by that time Confucianism had kind of come and gone and came back. But the basis of Confucianism, as Phil, is basically what we all, as I said, emotional, is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that's what Confucius, you know, all of you, read some of Confucius' writings, have that kind of basis, which I think has to do with the human condition based on emotion. Thou shalt not kill, those kinds of things. Not so much the senses, which I'm talking about, that are different. Because in Japanese, no V's, L's, or R's in the language beside that, so they don't hear. They don't hear it. They don't hear the L's. R is a D sound, and V's doesn't exist. So my son-in-law's a father, who I've known for 30 years, cannot pronounce my name Valerie. He tries. He tries. So it's interesting that you begin to knock out things very young that you don't hear.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. And so in other things, too, like seeing, and I've seen this happen with things that they see differently, as I said here in this paper, that what they see is different, and the more kind of lack of Japan is a weak culture, and so if you're doing business in Japan, if you're giving a presentation to the CEO and president and upper management, and they just say hi, that doesn't mean that they're accepting your presentation. If they do, you're going to wait maybe a year, because that has to go down all the way through the company to the guy who sweeps the floors. And then if they all decide that, okay, this sounds like a good plan, it happens instantly. Whereas in the Western culture, the CEO, president, vice president, upper management makes the ideas, and then they try to get the workforce to implement it, and then they hit the barriers.
Well, so, I argue the cultures are different. Whether there's a dichotomy between East and West, I guess, is the question.
Yes.
Because, I mean, here I'm constantly asking, is it guacamole or guacamole? And they just go, yeah. Because they don't hear the difference.
Yes.
You know, yes. So every culture, every baby screens out the sounds of their own, you know.
Right.
The other languages. And
so the TH sound in every language is only in Greek and English, theta. So that's why...
Yeah, that one's
Spanish, I think. Cannot
the
pronounce
fact that the Japanese can't recognize it between ours and ours.
Uh-huh.
What does that... See, my problem is that I think this dichotomy is arbitrary. And I don't see it as being any different from any other two cultures that have, like, Spanish and English. English and Greek and any other language. that it doesn't really impact significantly... on the way we think.
Well, it does, because I ended up doing a seminar for Westerners doing business in Japan, because they came back all upset. They had no idea what was going on. And then going through how Japanese culture works, they still had difficulty adapting to that mentality. And so that's, again, a frustration. You know, I think... Westerners come out with much more anger and quickness than the Eastern culture. That's why I like
being... Or the Mexican culture.
Pardon?
Or the Mexican culture. Mexican culture is all who you know. It's all networking.
Well, but I think, you know, that's coming back to the old time of the establishment of the United States and agrarian cultures and things like that. I will say this about...
I'll say real quickly.
Yeah.
I think, for me, the big dichotomy between the Mexican culture and the United States is that Mexico was an indigenous culture that was conquered, and then they threw out the conquerors, and they retained the indigenous culture. They learned how to hunker down into collectives to be safe, and they retained all of that when they ejected Spain. In the United States, we didn't get ejected. The conquerors came and they stayed. Mm-hmm. And they brought with them the independent thought process of leaving my homeland, leaving my family, striking out on my own across the prairie. And that's what accounts for the very extreme difference between the way we look at life.
Well, I don't want to go too far off base.
Well, I'm just saying that it came out of what they'd experienced. It was the way they coped with their reality, which I'm kind of curious as to how you think that came up in Japan and China.
It didn't, because Japan was never conquered.
I'm just saying, where did their culture come from?
With the Japanese?
Yeah.
Well, that's really fascinating, because the Ainu, which is the Honshu island, northern Japan, is really interesting, and I'm really kind of fascinated with... the Ainu have beards and hirsutes, you know, and the Japanese don't. It is interesting, and we don't know exactly where they've come from. So, I'm always interested in migrations and how, you know, are coming into Japan during the war. Interesting, why, if you know people who are Japanese, who I know, of course, from the United States and my family, I met my son-in-law's grandparents at the wedding when Mr. Yamaguma was 90 years old. And he was born in Japan, but brought to Hawaii at the age of 3. And he was put in the concentration camps in California with his daughter and his son. My son-in-law's mother and his grandmother were visiting in Japan, and Pearl Harbor broke out and they got caught in Japan. But I was interested in Mr. Yamaguma because, you know, Hawaii became a very Japanese, they lived tightly in Hawaii in their culture. And then coming to Los Angeles, they did the same thing. So they had problems with their language and very Japanese culture. But it was interesting to talk to Mr. Yamaguma about Hiroshima. And what was interesting was he thought, now how many of you think that when Pearl Harbor happened, what did you think that we thought about the Japanese armies? As the propaganda came out that they would fight to the last man. That's not true. And so in my research, because I do know that we only have one American president who understood that the Eastern world and battling the Eastern world was not the same as fighting in Europe. And so there was an organization set up after Pearl Harbor. A man named Robert Taylor of the University of Washington created this organization funded by the government with anthropologists. And he had kind of a large group. And they did research on the Japanese and found out, his name was Robert Taylor, that that wasn't true. That they were not willing to fight to the last man. And that was the propaganda that we were always told. And one of the reasons that, you know, why did Truman drop the bomb on Hiroshima? Because even as Mr. Yamaguma thought that they would fight to the last man. And I was surprised at doing all my research that that wasn't true, that already I did know the Japanese were at the White House trying to get to Roosevelt.
Yes.
Right, yes. And Roosevelt, my being Dutch and what's his name isn't here, we're Dutch. And I came from New York, a very racist family, 1600s. And so Roosevelt felt the Japanese were just those little yellow people. And he wouldn't listen to them. When Truman became president, he then listened to Richard Taylor. And he had them come. And he wanted to know everything possible. He was the only president who understood there was a big difference.
Then why did he feel he had to drop the bomb?
Pardon?
Why did he feel he had to drop the bomb?
Well, that's kind of like the World Trade Center. Yeah. It gets very complicated. There's no Occam's razor.
Was there any truth to the reports of the Japanese inhibition to surrender when fighting on the islands?
When what?
When fighting on the islands?
Yeah. Yes. That they
was we were always told that there was a disinhibition.
Exactly. Exactly.
They would not surrender.
That's what we were told.
Is that true?
No, it isn't. I have this whole paper on that organization, and it's rather fascinating about how the Japanese were trying their best to get to Roosevelt, to tell him and try to get involved with some type of surrender, some type of thing that their soldiers were coming out on the islands, giving up and surrendering.
So I go back to, if Truman knew all this, why would he do such a extreme thing?
Had a new toy to play
rather
with.
Rather than just negotiate a surrender with him.
That's again, kind of like the World Trade thing that you've been involved in for. And I've been to conferences on it, and there's no simple...
Huh.
And especially for me, living in Japan and going to Hiroshima, but why Nagasaki?
Uh-huh.
Why Nagasaki?
Why Nagasaki?
I never understood why Nagasaki.
So again, the issue of shame, national pride, honor.
Yeah.
Was always very, very strong. Again, was that just was that propaganda? Or
it was propaganda
real?
By us.
So things like Hari Kari.
So like Shogun, if I watch Shogun, I shouldn't believe in
him. Oh, don't. Don't.
Really?
If you want to read about Japan, read Endo by Silence and others. There's a book called Endo by Silence. It's called Silence, okay? Japanese. And so read that.
Okay.
Michener, he takes things from one historical period and then puts it in another. And Shogun had lots of problems.
Well, I know they did fight to the last man in the Battle of Attu. Two Japanese fellows made it. But the other thing that the Japanese soldiers were also getting propaganda, and they were being told that these Americans,
if you
surrender to those guys, they're going to do all kinds of bad things.
That's true. The Battle for Midway Island is a good thing about the Japanese perception of Americans that we would run. And the Battle for Midway, it was quite amazing that we threw up every plane that possibly could. Howard Hughes went up in a tower to photograph the battle. He came down after the first planes came in. So, but again, this is the idea of this problem, of the propaganda that we get from our perception of this other culture and their perception of us.
But we do, I mean, propaganda is ubiquitous in war. I mean, we always demonize the other side as being something they're probably not.
Yes, well, that's very true, that war brings out that kind of really hard propaganda. But in our books, too, for instance, European history makes no mention ever of Eastern history. And for instance, the first department store was not Beaumarchais or Fortnum & Mason in London. It was Mitsubishi it started in Kyoto and then moved to Edo at the time. So we've done things, and I think that how that happened was because of the Silk Road and the French going and seeing that advertising, Mitsui had been a samurai. And when the samurais went, he ended up with his wife making noodles, and then he created this whole kind of thing. And so we've taken on that as if we did it. And so, we still are doing this. Who really created, some technology or first? And so we're still stealing from the others. But in European history, there's no mention. We take credit for everything being the first. Mm-hmm. And so that, again, for me as being always a student, has infuriated me that these areas of the history have been taken out and then rewritten to make us feel good.
There's a certain arrogance in history, right?
Well, sure.
The history is written by the victors, right?
Yeah, but the history written by women is somewhat different.
I'm sure it would be. The history of England written by the poor people would be completely different from what I learned.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, in the 1980s in anthropology, there was a woman named Rocio, at UC Berkeley. And there was only four women allowed into the Department of Anthropology, the very first. And she did lots of studies in Asia and the Philippines on that. And so she had always been, she asked the question that threw the anthropology departments upside down. They took out the books because she was the first one to ask the question, what were the women doing while the men were out hunting? And actually, she developed a hunter-gatherer series. Unfortunately, she was killed back in the Philippines and her Jeep went off the road. And the interesting thing about her, being a woman, the flags in California were flown at half-mast for her. So it made me feel good that finally, to take just kind of like in what I just read about women in Japan and the children choosing the things their mothers are. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised by Christiana Amanpour. Did you see her series on sex? I was fascinated.
Pretty good.
About the Japanese women, because I knew a lot of Japanese women and things like that, that sex was not part of their marriage. Their husbands then would have sex with others. I was surprised because here it is, 2018, and they still had this.
But they virtually quit reproducing.
Well,
because there's so little interest in sex among young people. And very little interest in marriage because it's still a very traditional marriage. This is what I'm hearing. You can contradict me. It's still a very traditional marriage where he goes off to work for 12 hours a day and she stays home with the kids and goes out of
this
her mind.
Is another interesting thing, the difference between the Western and Eastern cultures, because things don't go away within a period of time. They're, one book on Japan said, underneath the surface, what you're seeing looks like Western, is old Japan. And I think we're seeing that coming forth now in the United States, not being that old, that the underneath is coming out again. And so, but under the Meiji Restoration, that 1868, the class system was, the merchant was at the very bottom. And you have the samurai, the shoguns, and whatnot at the top. And so at the bottom, being the merchant class, money was considered dirty. And to this day, what would happen is that men don't ride the trains on Friday night because they have to go home and give the money to their wife because it's dirty. She makes the decisions on where the children will be educated, everything that has to do with the family. And I found that in my Japanese family here in the U.S., that class system now, I wanted to know if it's changing a little bit about women, you know. But so this kind of class structure and role models, which we're certainly seeing still in our culture, still that attitude toward women, still, you know, heavily dug in. So in Japan, it's also the same. Now, the difference basically in China is a little bit different. And that's why China and Japan are not similar. The language is extraordinarily different than Chinese. I can't deal with Chinese. I just have them write out for me a note. But the differences are quite amazing. So when I'm talking about the Eastern world, I am talking about China and Japan in that way. Because even China, though, the British were in for 150 years, but they were only in the Hong Kong area and the islands, not in the immense country of Japan, of China.
How fundamental do you see the difference? Because I'm hearing there's cultural differences. I think there's differences between all cultures.
Uh-huh. Sure.
You know.
Sure.
But what I understood, what from my reading is that there's a lot of people being saying that due to their geography, their past history, their predominant religions, there is a fundamental difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A fundamental difference between how they perceive the world.
That's right. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
But I've only heard the cultural difference. Well, what are the fundamental? I mean, they believe in logic, right?
Yes, they do, but in a different perception of the way they go about it, you know, constructing the logic. So it's very difficult in a philosophical talk, as I've found with my husband or my son-in-law's family, to talk philosophically. We try to mesh through it. But
what is the difference? I don't understand.
Because of their, as I said, their way of from the very time of birth, with the idea of reincarnation, time elements, the notion of time, which I think maybe we could have a lecture and talk about that, because the studies on time are kind of amazing. And
Maybe amazing, but what are they?
Well, it's a concept. It's hard to put you can't say it's this, this, and this. It's a concept. We come into the world with a calendar and a clock, and we stick to that in a schedule kind of thing. They don't. There's a whole kind of way of approaching things that is much more broad and encompassing as a we.
But not when you talk about calendars and you talk about time.
But time. But we use time as a independent source. Okay? You meet me at 3 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Okay? We're going to have a meeting at 3 o'clock. Now we get that. Okay? They don't do that kind of thing in some ways. It's more of a different kind of approach as to how you come about it.
Oh, yeah.
And this is where Phil. This
so what is the alternative? What is the alternative here?
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is they do have the meetings, but the thing about it is once there, okay, there's a whole kind of custom embedded in the culture about how you're going to go about it and the thinking. And when you don't
same in any two cultures.
Yeah. Well, not quite, because I've told American men about okay, you're going to Japan. And I was sitting in Tokyo in a hotel and listening to them saying, I don't know what happened. But the idea is that you can't come away. If there's no future tense and there's no word for no, I'm not going to tell you, but I want you to think about that. What does that mean? Philosophically, mentally.
Okay. How do they negate things? How do they...
There's a negative. All verbs end in the same thing. The affirmative is masu.
So they cannot express no.
No. What you say is if I'm in the store, department store, and I see something, and then I don't want it, I say in Japanese, that's very nice. That's
okay.
It. Because... what it means is, first of all, it's very existentialist without future tense. Without no, unlike in the Western world, when you say no, it's a direct negative, I don't want that, which brings you back onto that person. So there, what they're acknowledging is what you have in your presentation, you've brought to us. You've brought it into existence. Therefore, we accept its existence. And for them to then say in their ways of projecting it that it's very nice, but they have to come away saying with the acknowledgement that it is exist and we acknowledge you. And so, but it's not for us at this time. But they can't say it. They say it in a way that's affirmative.
Are you aware here,
yes,
and this my friends have told me many times, my Mexican friends, that when somebody comes to sell you something you don't want, you don't say no gracias,
no,
you just say gracias.
Yes, muchísimas gracias.
I cannot do that because it feels to me like I'm saying thank you for showing it to me. It doesn't feel like I'm negating it at all.
Uh-huh.
But they all understand that a simple gracias means that you don't put the no in front.
Yes.
And that it's a little rude to put the no in front,
yes,
which I still do.
Yes.
And that
you know,
is just a cultural, something that's developed in the culture.
Well, I do believe that in the culture it goes to your unconscious level, absolutely. The things that you don't realize, that you don't consciously realize.
Japanese or Chinese mathematicians or physicists or not?
Are there what?
Have there been any great mathematicians or physicists in Japan?
Oh, yes.
Do they have their own set of theories?
What kind of mathematics did they discover?
Well, I know you're the mathematician.
I've never heard of a Japanese.
The Chinese
contemporary mathematicians in Japan, but 100 years ago, or more, I don't think there have been any Japanese theorems. Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, no, I can't tell you that, Henry.
Physics.
Certainly there's engineers, right? I mean, all that engineering coming out
well,
of there.
That's
today, but
I don't.
100 years ago, was there a Gauss? Was there a Fermat? Was there a...
That's the other thing. I think things are changing so rapidly in the world because of the internet and things like that, that, for instance, in Mexico, I believe the current generation, the kids who are 20-ish right now, are very different from their parents, and that it has changed very suddenly.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about...
I was kind of wondering if that's happening
times,
in Japan, too.
The great mathematicians that I know of are English, German, French, Italian, you know, they're all European.
Uh-huh.
But
I've heard the man from India who...
There's one Indian.
Well, so many of them are Indian.
But he's only one, really. I mean, the big names are all European.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying, is that we're indoctrinated with our...
But I'm wondering if that's really true. Are there any famous 100-year-old
I'm sure there are. And Henry, I couldn't... But I was interested in why... From Egypt, okay? One of the things I've noticed...
Because mathematics is very antithetical to that kind of thinking. You have to go down the rabbit hole. You have to follow, you have to have, premise, conclusion, and keep on going, which doesn't sound like Eastern thoughts. So I would think
to a great kind of thing in the development technology
today,
and whatever.
But not back, you're talking about...
Well, 3,500 years ago in India, they brought in the zero, which we've only found in the Mayan calendar. Yes. And so...
since then, there hasn't been a lot of Eastern, as far as I know, mathematics or physics. I mean, it's all come from the West. the scientific method, I think, did that exist 100 years ago?
So today? The engineers for Samsung and all those are all...
That's today.
No. Okay. So you're saying in this generation it has changed.
Yeah, but you know, back when we were doing... The Europeans were doing, you know, what is air pressure? What is chemistry? What is, you know, how do those things work? Was anybody working on that in Japan?
I think the Chinese were doing that way before the Westerners were doing it, weren't they?
But not in a
astronomy, figuring out how long it took the Earth to go around, you know, doing pure physics.
Did the Japanese and the Chinese know that the Earth was going around the sun?
I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
The Chinese were great astronomers.
Did they know it
was
in balloons?
I don't think so.
100 years ago, they were building airplanes.
I'm talking about 2000 years ago. In the Renaissance times.
Before Western influence.
Exactly.
Before Western
influence got there, were there astronomers who would be able to predict the orbits of the planets?
I really doubt it.
Especially
in China.
I really doubt it. Not with mathematics, I don't think.
Yes,
that would be really interesting.
You have to send me a reference on that. I will.
They
might have been able to predict it based on past history we see it happens every 5 years, so it's going to happen in 5 years.
No.
But I really doubt that they had equations that they could write down that said this is the orbit of the moon and this is the orbit of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. But see, I mean, history, we always say history is going forward, but it doesn't. It cycles, right?
Right.
And every part of the world gets its time to be ahead of everybody else. And I'm sure the Chinese were way ahead of everybody else in their time.
Oh, sure. Back you know, when we were barbarians. But during the Renaissance time and during the time of
the scientific revolution.
Right, you're talking about the Renaissance in the Western world.
Right.
Okay, 1401.
Yeah, so
everybody woke up in Florence, Italy and said, aha, today's
there was a huge movement towards science, let's do experiments, let's see how it works.
But you're eliminating totally without, you know, studying. And certainly, I've never, even with years, been able to study as much, because Chinese history is so complicated, so complex, so large, that I can't answer you on those kind of questions. But I do know that the development of Chinese culture was much higher than the Western culture.
Maybe in terms of airy-fairy stuff, but I don't think in terms of science.
Didn't China come up with an accounting system?
They're little things, but I'm not aware of. And okay. I'm not saying it doesn't
see,
exist.
Here
I just am not aware of.
Needham, and I don't know who they're referring to, some modern astronomer, has described the ancient Chinese as the most persistent and accurate observers of celestial phenomena anywhere in the world before the Islamic astronomers.
Exactly.
So there was definitely a time when it wasn't airy-fairy. They were observing and recording exactly what they were seeing.
Were they using those observations to come up with a theory of gravity, for example? I don't think so. Newton did that.
I don't know about that.
that was a revolution.
Well, that's what I was saying.
Yeah, that's the difference between, in my mind, Western thought and Eastern thought. Mm-hmm. Eastern thought's very general, very fuzzy, very cloudy. I can't quite see what their point is. Whereas Western thought is very to the point. This works. This is how you write down the equation. This is how you do it. And I'm really good at that. I like that.
Let me add something to what Henry is saying, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Would anyone dispute the premise, or the conclusion rather, that modern civilization is essentially based on Western thought, not Eastern thought?
Absolutely true.
Okay. Would anybody dispute that?
Well, what do you mean by modern civilization?
Modern civilization in China is based on Eastern thought. The modern civilization we see around the world today, I would assert, is based on Western thought to the exclusion of Eastern thought. Would anybody disagree with that?
Okay. You have to define what you mean by modern civilization. Do you mean the fact that we're building dams and sending people to the moon, or do you mean
all of that?
The way that people live their daily lives?
The
way that people live their daily lives is still very influenced by their own particular culture.
Yes.
I mean, the way they relate to each other.
The way progress is made is based on Western thought.
Progress is Western, though, you know, so say it's based on Western thought, we're looking at a Western phenomenon saying it's based on Western thought, obviously. There's other kinds of progress that are, you know what I'm saying, that are based on other kinds of thought. I don't consider what we, you know, the progress of engineering and all of that to be the ultimate progress. Progress of humanitarianism, to me, would be much better progress, which we're very, very bad at in the United States, pretty good at in a place like Sweden, I think. Pretty good at in a place, well, I don't know.
Well, let me pick up on that, Sandy. Would you assert that the modern idea of human rights came out of Eastern thought or Western thought?
That's a good question.
Western thought.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I tend to do
So if you look at the big things, whether it's technology or something like...
Yeah, I would say human rights is
like
that each individual has the right to live their life the way, because we're very individualistic. But to say that the society has an obligation to support each other is not Western thought.
That's Western thought too.
Just not
Republican.
Huh?
It's just not Republican.
Yeah. Because in Scandinavian countries they have that.
Right. Exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
And in Germany, France, all of Europe.
Well, about
the 1948 United Nations Declaration of Human Rights is essentially based on Western thought or Eastern thought.
Well.
Which almost every country in the world has adopted.
Well, as I said in the very beginning, it was 550 BC. No, 550 BC, Confucius ideas of the Golden Rule were established. That's human rights. That's human rights. Long before Christianity or the Western world took on that concept. The only thing that
You can draw a line from that to the 1948.
Yeah.
Declaration of the United Nations?
Well, you know, I would think so, because I think that basically underneath in the human mind, in the human sensibility, understanding, without war.
Well, I'm like Henry. I need the reference if I'm willing to entertain the idea, but okay. I'm not aware of anybody ever having asserted that the United Nations Declaration of 1948 was based
certainly,
on Eastern thought.
I know. That's,
there's probably a paper that says that someplace, but I've never heard that before.
Well, that's the contention of the thing we're debating. Okay, because I was indoctrinated until I was 35 years old into the Western thought. Until I was pushed into having to deal with Japanese culture, and then in the later years, the rest of Eastern. And then I realized, because the way you're speaking, and Henry, I would have said the same thing. See, at St. John's, I had this problem also of being indoctrinated, having to deal with seminars dealing only with the Golden Age of Greece. That was very difficult.
But it's a very different question.
No, I'm just saying that you're ignoring the idea. And even when I've said to you that Confucius did it 550 B.C., the idea of the Golden Rule, which brought
about
human
rights. So did the Buddha just about the same time.
Yes.
I'm not saying that didn't happen. I'm talking about taking those ideas. Lots of ideas emerged in cultures and died. The oldest body of thought that I'm aware of is Hinduism, which goes back about 4,000 years. There was lots of great ideas, but to trace that to the rise of modern civilization is what I'm talking about. So,
what was in the Declaration of Human Rights? What do you consider a human right?
Well, the 1948 Declaration is a document well worth reading. It's not that long.
But can you just kind of summarize? You know, is it the right? Because when I look at like Chinese culture,
it is the most definitive definition of human rights as we practice it today in the world, worldwide.
So if we just take an example of child brides, okay? So we would consider that to go against the girl's right to choose her own.
That's on your iPhone.
The right not to be tortured.
Huh?
Yes.
The right not to be
okay.
tortured.
But the right not to be forced into marriage as a child. The right to choose your own spouse.
Many things like
okay?
that.
Okay. So, and that is obviously very Western, because in most Eastern cultures, up until very recently, the parents always chose the spouse.
I wish I'd have been able to do that.
But to them, it created a more peaceful civilization for everybody and a better civilization for everybody. To have the parents choosing if you see what I'm saying, to them that was that actually did arise for a better civilization. Even when I look at it, I find it repugnant. And I don't believe in it, and I would fight for any girl's right to choose her own spouse.
Well, Sandra, we have
from their point of view, it might be a human right for the parents to choose your children's spouse. If you see what I mean, because to them it led to a more stable society that was better for everybody in the end.
Well, yeah. I'm not but sure the point you're making, but most Eastern countries have signed on to the United Nations
right.
Declaration of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a handful of countries that haven't.
Okay, let me take a different example. The right of a person to be supported by the society to the extent of receiving health care from your society. That you have the right to receive health care from your society, which of course the United States, a lot of people still don't believe in, but in Japan, everybody believes in.
And what?
The right of an individual to receive health care from your society.
Yes, but we're digressing from...
Yeah, I want to make one more point to Valerie, if I may.
Yeah, I don't know if you're getting what I'm saying.
Well, to finish my point, when I'm asserting that modern civilization is essentially based on Western thought, I am not saying that there is not a great deal that we... cannot learn from Japan or from China or from ancient Hinduism. There's a lot of good knowledge there that is undervalued in the West.
That's true.
What we can learn from other cultures and other civilizations is a different question than what is the basis of modern civilization today. Mm-hmm. That's the only distinction I'm making.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, as Sai and you have said, that Buddhism and the meditation has taken on a big thing here in Mexico and the United States, that more people are getting, involved with it. Interesting that the idea of zero that I researched was, it brought into the culture the idea of mindfulness, and it brought in meditation, which is part of their daily life from children on, which we don't do. We do meditate at times and things like that, but it's part of a whole kind of basis to your being born in the Eastern world, is this, mindlessness of the zero, and then the continual meditation, which started in India and then came across. And it's certainly a big part of Japanese life and Chinese life. And it brings up, if you've been indoctrinated that from birth, your thought processes and things are a totally kind of a different kind of concept. And so I disagree with the idea of modern civilization being Western, because I've seen incredible kind of civilization in these Eastern countries. And to dismiss that as if they're all based on,
Because we're looking at it from our point of view, we dismiss it, right?
Exactly. We dismiss it. Exactly. We dismiss it. And sometimes it does get tiresome dealing with it. I certainly found myself, I give myself a diploma every time moving into a different country, the day that I finally feel comfortable. And then I feel, I've got it, that I can.
But that's your perception.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is, I know, but see, in Japan...
You may be completely misguided.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But all of a sudden, I found myself, having to wake up. It was tiring living in Japan with no ability to read.
Well,
or
I can imagine, yeah.
So, and with three daughters, three children, and also the Japanese way of doing business was devastating for my husband. They do work 7 days a week. And so when he'd leave on Friday, he had to put out a whole schedule for them. And it was overwhelming.
The Japanese have a word for working yourself to death?
Is that true?
That's actually true?
Uh-huh. Because Don came home one night and he said, either I'm really sick or Japanese business has gotten to me. And so it was, even my husband was very adaptable in all countries. And I used him in my seminar on intercultural living and business. But Japan was extraordinarily different
to deal with it. Do you find, again, I just,
I'm amazed that there's so much written about the difference between West and East.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When to me, it's no more different than any other cultural difference throughout the world. You can pick any two cultures. They just happen to be far away from one another.
Mm-hmm.
And the differences may be more obvious, but I can pick cultures in anywhere, in Africa. Look at the Middle East.
I can give you an example. There's a different culture between Northern Germany and Southern Germany.
Yes.
Exactly. In England, too. Yeah. You know,
Northern United States and Southern Germany.
Exactly.
But you
we can't understand the mindset of, you know, the South of the U.S.
That's true.
Voting for someone against their own interests.
Right.
Phil, I can give you one example.
No, we have trouble because I'm a Southerner.
I can give you one example where this plays out, where the difference of the way the minds work actually makes a difference. If you look at, and I'm generalizing, lots of exceptions. If you look at neuroscientists today, and if you look at those neuroscientists who have studied and deeply understand Buddhism versus those who have a worldview that is highly oriented to science alone, you will see insights. I would assert that those neuroscientists, we're talking in the Western world, research, that they're coming up with different conclusions. For example, the very definition of what a mind is.
Mm-hmm.
You will argue, probably, as we have in the past, that the mind and the brain are essentially the same, right?
Oh, we did have that argument.
it is those neuroscientists with an understanding, or some of them are practicing some of the Buddhist techniques, that are far more open to the idea that there may be something different than the physical.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a field, and there is implications of that, implications in the mental health field and in psychotherapy. That is an area where the influence of Buddhism appears to be very positive.
As I would think just the influence of Christianity would take them there, would take them to that same place.
No.
That there's something, that their soul. I mean, the whole idea of soul is the thing, is the ethereal thing beyond your brain.
The Buddhist idea is really quite different than the Christian idea of a soul.
Mm-hmm.
I understand they're different, but what I'm saying is those two beliefs could both take you to the same place.
Yes.
The whole idea of soul is that when I die, I live on. When I die, there's a piece of me that doesn't die, that has nothing to do with my physics, the physics of my body. And so you would think that any Christian scientist would take that into consideration when they're doing their research. That's what soul is.
Mm.
Well, I'm not saying everybody believes that's what it is.
What is the difference?
Well, the way it plays out is...
any Christian scientist.
It's complicated, but I'll try to. It really comes down to the difference between studying the mind as an objective fact from external.
Right.
I'm trying to understand your mind from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
What Buddhism opens up is exploring the mind from within. Okay, it's the difference between an emphasis on the objective and an acceptance of something that can only be subjective. Studying the mind from within, I'll defend Western thought as the basis of civilization. Buddhism, from what I can put together, has had a much better understanding of the human mind that goes right back to the original Buddha. And it is because of the value on the subjective in contrast to an emphasis on the objective and the objective only.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big difference.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's more than theory. There's a lot of tension in psychotherapy today, and the I'll generalize again. The Western idea is that to solve a mental health problem, you administer a drug to the brain, which hasn't gotten us nearly where we had hoped to be, versus working within the mind itself. So a very Western way of thinking is the brain, all mental thought comes from the brain, so you affect the brain chemistry and you solve the problem. Buddhism is much more open to a whole different model than that model.
It sounds like the difference between psychiatry and psychology.
It goes deeper than
that.
But my last talk
at Open Circle, I talked exactly about that and how the scientific world had resisted so much studying the inner workings of the mind until they could picture it via PET scans and MRIs and all that. Once they could finally look into the brain and see that things were happening, then they were okay with it. But I think you're right. I mean, the acceptance of the idea that the mind can change itself.
Yeah,
without
I want to tell you about one thing I heard today on my program I listened to. There's this kid, his name is U, his letters were UD. He did was in a study. He had a tumor the size of a baseball when he was 3 years old in his brain, and they removed it. And then they followed him through his life. And they could, after a few years, they could detect no difference between him and a child with a full brain. Mm-hmm. And the part that was removed was the visual processing part that deals with faces. And when they put him in the fMRI machine, they saw that the left brain part of the brain took over that processing. So even though he was missing a significant portion of his brain, there was zero difference that from the outside between him and a normal 12-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm. But if he had lost it at 30, it would have been a very different
story. That's a very different story. Mm-hmm. Right. But the plasticity of the brain at that age was shocking to the researchers.
Yeah. Yeah.
They resisted it.
But unfortunately,
the evidence was right in front of them.
Right.
Yeah, unfortunately, as you know, they're Romanian children that were adopted. And they found that the adoptive parents in the U.S. finally wanted to give the children back. And they took brain scans of the children because they had put in cribs and not touched. Mm. And so there was black areas in their brain where they didn't have that ability to attach, which was strange. But also, I find language also. I think my Italian's here, my Japanese here, my French here. It's all in different areas. And so it's very strange, the whole idea. But
can I just ask John? The goal of Buddha was to do what? What was his goal?
His goal was to end suffering.
Yeah.
And his first two statements were, all existence involves suffering.
Yeah.
All suffering arises from indulgence or desire.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that's a statement of the problem. The next two were...
But his goal was to end suffering.
To end suffering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is the goal of someone who... psychiatrist who's treating someone who's mentally tortured with mental illness?
The same.
End of suffering.
End of suffering. Mm-hmm. So basically, I mean, when you say there's two models of mind, the goal is the same. Right? It's a very subjective thing, right? That you want to alleviate that subjective feeling of... Yeah, the method is different.
Yeah,
yes, but all of life, from the time you're born, regardless of if you have mental deficiencies or whatnot, or trauma or whatnot, is the same. That we all understand that you don't go through life without suffering. You're going to suffer. So Buddhism, Siddhartha, in the very beginning, the thing about, and you can speak to this, John, is Siddhartha, is that it was very, very pure as far as its concept. And it's like Christianity grew and it grew. Buddhism now is nothing like the very first premise of Siddhartha. And so I think that's what we don't want to get mixed up with. And we get mixed up when we talk about Christianity with all that complex. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like your Occam's razor. You can go back down to the simple explanation.
One of the unfortunate things about Buddhism over the years is many people have made a religion of it. And it is not a religion. It is not a religion. Way of life.
Well, exactly. It can be a religion.
It well, it made it. They that, made you know, it. They
it's a religion
in.
To some of the people in the Far East.
Yeah.
It's a religion.
But they
it's
do things that the Buddha has never done. Or done
well, they've added a supernatural element that wasn't there. They've added a supernatural element that wasn't there in the original. Right.
Well, that I found out.
Craving is suffering, and the only way to get rid of suffering is to get rid of craving. That was what it came down to. And here's how you do it, you know, and...
And so had, that, that's what I found out about this Master Kong, who was later named Confucius, that he basically made his concepts a religion. And then later, it all went away. And then it was reinstituted in China because of their different types of sensibilities into a non-religion concept of just, you know, the concept of human rights and life. And so that interested me, that really this...
So Confucius wanted it to be a religion, are you saying?
His name was Wang.
Okay, because Buddha definitely didn't.
No. This is Confucianism.
Yeah.
And so still today in China, the basic premise of Chinese is Confucianism.
But there's no... is there a supernatural... Well, I know that Chinese believe in a ton of supernatural, but does Confucianism have a supernatural element?
No.
Okay.
No. So, you
neither did Taoism either.
Yeah, Taoism too. They're very closely.
They were rivals though. Taoism and Confucianism.
Yeah. Well, if you don't mind, I'll read a quick thing about those religions between.
Just a minute. I'm just asking. Yeah.
Yes. Uh huh.
Because having a daughter at 17, spend a year in Japan, and coming back very different mentally, very much more disciplined.
Right.
And I could see the way she was handling life that she had a change in culture.
Yeah.
And pain and her mother, which I question now whether I should have ever done it. I said to her, "If you're in Japan, you should take judo." So the champion group judo, the girls at 17 was practicing in Kyushu, which is a southern
Kyushu.
So she joined that for a year. And the discipline, if she saw somebody in pain, she could not respond. She had to learn all sorts of different Buddhist mental thoughts. And she's maintained a lot of it.
So what do you mean she couldn't respond?
No, if you saw somebody get hurt, you had to stay very meditative. You couldn't respond.
You couldn't help them? See, the Buddha would never say you couldn't help them. They would say, if you get all panicky, that's not going to do anybody.
There's something about whatever it was in that.
Oh, interesting.
There were so many interesting things.
Somebody helped them, right? I mean,
yeah. Okay.
That's all right. The point of having a Japanese health service.
Yeah. But she came back with so many different ways of looking at life. And then, of course, learning Japanese, you learn it from the other side of the brain, so much of it.
Well, I'm sure that would be true. I'm sure it's true of any culture.
It is, and you have to do it at a certain age.
My premise against the East-West was that the difference is arbitrary.
Right. But I'm just saying, at a certain age, if you go after, and people told me that, we had a close friend that was Japanese, and they said, if she learns it before 18 or 19, she'll be able to retain and learn it in a whole different way, the other side of the brain, than as you get older.
Well, that's true of my daughters who've had to learn four languages, and they were all 2 and 6, 5 and 6 when we started moving around the world, and they're all trilingual and 1-4 languages, and they learned it so much more quickly than myself, unfortunately. So, but you know, if we're talking about Chinese philosophy, do you mind if I read this quickly? It's just a couple pages. Okay, so this is Chinese philosophy. The clouds look like piled up mountains. The mountains look like gathering clouds. Clouds, mountains, how do you tell the difference? The clouds are white, the mountains are green. Okay, that was from Hum Tao. Confucius explained upon viewing the painting, it's a painting. My first measure after taking administrative office will concern the rectification of names. This will aid the superior man with regard to what he does not know and enable him to maintain an attitude of reserve. If there is not a rectification of names, then language will not be in accord with truth, and things will not be accomplished. In words, all that matters is to express the meanings. Therefore, it will be rectified that those are clouds, and they are green, and those are mountains, and they are white. Now, knowing the language is in accord with truth, we can administer the people. Some years later, a student, upon observing the painting, hanging onto Mencius' wall, Mencius, another philosopher, why is it that Confucius said the mountains were white when in fact they are green? Mencius replied, the great man did not insist that his words be necessarily truthful or his actions be necessarily resolute. He acted only according to righteousness. Confused, the student asked, why do you not rectify the truth? Since for you the truth is that the mountains are green and the clouds are white. Mencius calmly answered, the circumstances do not merit it, because to teach is to administer correct principles. If these correct principles are not practiced, I would be angered. To admonish others would lead to alienation, and nothing is more offensive than alienation. As time moved on, the painting was found in the house of Hyun Soo, who was lecturing to a group of students. Without question, nature has given vision to man's eye, but clarity is not outside his eye. Since man's nature is originally evil, clear vision cannot be learned. Therefore, it was necessary for us, men of wisdom, to develop through convention and through the common perception and feelings of things, an establishment of clear distinctions and an allocation of names to actualities. Names which had no correctness of their own are not now correct, and hence there will be no danger of misunderstandings. Thus the mountains are green and the clouds are white. This clarification will enable you to single-mindedly follow the law and obey orders. Only in this manner can we achieve results in obtaining good government. Since our sage kings are dead, we will have to closely guard the names so confusion will not occur. In the year 221 BC, the Qin came to power. All literature, books, and art were burned in the big bonfire the previous night. The new king could not quite bring himself to give up his painting, so he hid it in a secluded niche in the palace where it hung in position two. It was thought that because water flows and boats float, the ruler, following the same course of nature, could declare and enforce new laws for the kingdom. Thereafter, a subject in want of knowledge, of which all had been abolished, in order to carry out his new command, asked the enlightened king, what is that I see out your window? The ruler, peeking at his painting for help, declared, those are white mountains and green clouds. For a time, the state was ruled in confusion. As time passed, the people came to reject all words and forms as descriptions of the ultimate reality and reduce themselves to conversing in pure talk. In the continuum of time, Tao, who remains nameless, dwelled in the realm of the painting. As a Taoist monk contemplated the painting, the lines of differentiation between the mountains and clouds vanished, and the color and objects formed as one with his body. He was not fooled by mountains, clouds, greenness, and whiteness, for he was one and in total harmony with all. Chosei, upon seeing the painting, removed it from the wall while the monk remained oblivious to the blank spot left by the picture. While Chosei was setting the painting in front of him, he muttered, it is with my mind that I rule my body. I control the external world of what I see. It does not control me. It is what the great Master Chang called straightening the internal life and concentrating on one thing, namely for me, this painting. My mind and body will be serious, and I will unify the internal and the external worlds. Wang Chengming has quietly put the painting away in a closet. Chu Si, his mind having been numbed from years of concentrated, took no notice that the painting was gone. Wang thought to himself, there have been too many small men who have made a cleavage between what they call mountains and clouds. When will they learn that only great men regard heaven, earth, and the myriad of things as one body? For it is the nature of man's mind to do so. Wang Fuqi paid a visit to Wang one day. While putting his umbrella in the closet, he spotted the painting and seized it. Admonishing Wang, he cried, "You have no appreciation for concrete things. This painting possesses a fine ordering of the world, demonstrating its inherent principles. See the beauty of the green mountains and the white clouds? Concrete things are different today than they were in the past. We cannot make the past a pattern for today." Today in China, it is said that the mountains are green and the clouds are white. I wrote that. So this is kind of a line of the development of different thoughts through different dynasties in China as to Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and Mencius. And so times just kind of move away from how we see things as I brought that painting.
So it was the year 221 BCE that the emperor burnt the history of China?
Yeah, that was the Han China doing away with the Qin dynasty, where they killed all the intellectuals.
Yeah, I've always wondered what that did to their subsequent thought development.
Well, I
said change the clouds degree.
Yeah. 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 Well, then of course Mao comes in our time, our lifetime, yeah. And he does the same thing. And I think we're experiencing that in the
United States now. And now we have a president who thinks the mountains are white and the clouds are green.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Today's president. Yeah. Yes. So there is an element of what I said is based in the human emotions that is connected across the world.
That's, you know, historically, I still wonder, this is kind of my own thing, like, China's kind of cut off because of that burning. You know, it's hard to go previous to that. But did it all, was there a kernel somewhere that it all came from? I mean, we could say, we can locate a kernel of our present thought clear back in Samaria.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. But was there a kernel in, say, the Middle East or whatever?
Yeah, not the
Middle East. From China. Does it all go back to one?
That's really interesting, because being in Jerusalem, I was kind of fascinated that all these religions spiked out from the same place in the world and went. And the further out they go, the more kind of fundamental they remain. Mm-hmm. The closer to the source, the less fundamental they are.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the Vatican. You live in Rome and...
It's less fundamental?
Yes. Yes.
The Vatican is less fundamental.
Yes, if you live in Rome. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The Vatican isn't, the people who live by the Vatican.
Yeah, just no. Where the basis of Christianity is, mm-hmm. that I found, you know, that it was interesting. That it is less, my mother-in-law, who Roman Catholic, went to a mass there, and she was upset because you don't do it.
They weren't doing it right.
No, and being in Barcelona for Christmas, I was stunned because there is no Christmas. There was no lights, nothing. And I was surprised, you know. And so the only place you could buy a Christmas tree was at Gaudi's La Familia Sagrada Cathedral.
But it's very difficult. With modernity and, you know, social media, it's very difficult to look at any culture and say, you know, and extrapolate it into the past. You know, I mean, you look at, what are you going to make of wandering around Costco in Mexico and seeing all the Halloween stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are you going to learn from Mexico culture from?
Yeah.
From that?
Well, I found that the idea of Halloween, which is really a children's kind of holiday, that...
If you're here, if you're somewhere else, it's All Hallows Eve, it may be a completely different thing.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. But my children instituted it in London. And
but it's very difficult. It's very difficult now to look at anything and say, well, they're not doing it right, or, you know, because, you know, it's become so polluted by...
Yeah, well, I think Halloween's not a good example of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because my children then took advantage of Guy Fox Day, you know, anything.
Because you can look at, you know, the way Japan and China, where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you still hear this, there's this fundamental difference between East and West and why we can't really, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. understand what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking when the Chinese are negotiating with Apple, you know, about price per unit.
They don't have any trouble.
Yeah. I mean, they, you know, right. The concepts, I don't see any difference in the concept.
Well, Not really. It's the way of the development and negotiation and things like
that. Well, sure. I mean, that's true in every culture. It's true in, you know, in the difference between the UK and the US. It's true between every culture has a different way.
Americans who are sent overseas.
Their customs and rituals.
Yeah.
But you know, the layer beneath that is, mm-hmm. is the fundamental difference that everyone seems to believe exists between East and West.
Well, I can say that I am not an authority on the Eastern world, and I don't think even at 81 and going off to Vietnam again to study that I'll ever in my lifetime have a good grasp of it's too vast and too much to make me kind of, I have a problem with people call themselves expert. I just say I'll have some expertise having, you know, lived, studied, and whatnot, but not an expert.
But you don't have to go to Vietnam to experience that. I mean, living here, are just scratching the surface. We don't understand what's going on underneath here either.
Well,
it's in jeans, and it looks so, you know, they're using their cell phones, it looks so similar.
Yes, but I think that you, in order to even begin to understand your confusion and misconception of the Eastern world is you have to go live, be doing business, and be involved with that. And I thought my first time in Kobe, Japan, where we had to live 6 million people because it only had, the children couldn't go to a Japanese school. It takes 7 years to learn to read and write Japanese. So they went to, as Leslie calls it, Canadian Canatomy. And so, the first day that I was down in the Motomachi, the street where the shopping mall happens, and I'm obviously not Japanese, and I'm standing above, and there are just hundreds storming past me, you know? And I thought at that point, I laughed because I was upset that I knew nothing about them. And I thought, either two types of Americans come, and when this happens to them, like it did for my older brother, he wanted to get out of Japan. He was there on business. He couldn't deal with it. And I just laughed because I thought to myself, all these people think differently than I do, believe differently than I do.
But stand outside there and watch them walk by.
Sandy, I just think about the East, that Sandy. I just had to laugh. And then I opened myself up to wanting to learn and whatnot, but knowing I would never, as I said.
Same the whole world.
Same ever understood.
I mean, we've been married 30 years. I still don't understand a lot of the way the English think. It still causes conflicts that we don't even realize are coming from the different
cultures.
Well,
as a cross-cultural trainer, the one country in the world that assignees are assigned to overseas in the Western world that they ask to come back from the quickest. What do you think it is?
Say that again.
Overseas assignees, like IBM, any of them, sent overseas. What country do you think they want to come back to the U.S. the fastest from? They can't deal with.
No idea.
It happens to be the U.K.
Maybe.
I know many Americans who love living in the U.K.
Well, I do too. But the mistaken notion
is that they're the same.
Yeah. And they come into conflict right away.
Yeah.
And you can really bash and make mistakes in cultural customs in the U.K.
Sure.
Yeah. Really quickly.
Have a look at American businesses moving into Canada.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's quite a story.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Uh-huh. Right.
It didn't work. You really think of Canada as being similar.
Some of them work.
Yeah.
But if you go into Canada with the assumption that what you do in the United States will work in Canada, uh-huh. it tends not to work. Target moved into Canada, closed their doors.
Yes. So this is mainly big businesses? Is it big businesses, or does it translate to little businesses, too?
Well, little business tends to be local, so you don't get American little business in Canada. Yeah. But it's all
Target.
Big business.
Yeah.
So
why did Target fail?
I know, just failed in Vancouver.
Who knows?
I don't know. But there is a pattern of large American failures. Why that one specifically failed? Walmart,
they're working with the unions. I know that was true for Walmart. Mm-hmm. Walmart didn't want to capitulate anything to the union, so rather than do that, they shut down.
Well, why IBM never was eliminated from any country, kicked out of any country, it's Tom Watson, senior founder, 1938 when he went international. people think that the world is peopled with U.S. IBMers or not. Because he said that in the countries, the natives of that country will have 40% ownership of IBM and will be the upper management. And that we only came in, there's only a few of us families, as troubleshooters. But that was why IBM never, and then India did something very stupid. They wanted 60% control. The Japanese certainly wanted 60% control, but they did understand that we pull out. So IBM said to India, which was really stupid, we will not give you that control. And it was a big battle. And so finally IBM pulled out of India.
So what happens in when Microsoft installs Windows? I'm sure there's a Japanese version of Windows.
Oh, sure.
So what happens when it says, when your little window pops up and it says, do you want to, whatever the question is, yes or no?
there's no button for no.
There's no button for no. Yes or thank you very much.
Yes or not. I want to add just one thing that Sandy said earlier, is that the 20-year-olds are so different today than they were when we were.
Sure.
Young.
Oh, so different.
So that window, how do the 20-year-olds think about that in Japan, and how do the 20-year-olds think about that in England? And it's different than what we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. We should have one here.
Is it, or are we looking at the difference between modernity and pre-modernity?
I don't know. It's a good question.
That's...
Because they're really, because of the change in technology.
Because a lot of people,
the world.
A lot of people ask me about Mexico and the U.S. What's the difference? I saw people in Mexico are more friendly. It's really the difference between.